Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And I'm actually, before we start off, welcome back, Tammy. And so glad to have you on a regular basis now. Yay! Because everybody prefers Tammy. So we were talking because nobody knows what we were actually saying because we didn't have the recording going. But we were talking about opportunity costs. I understand the exigencies. I think many, many people, you know, are losing sleep because the time is growing nigh, right? I guess that's one way of saying it. And so what do we do and how can we change our path effectively? We have to constantly look at what we're doing and is what we're doing actually the best use of our time? Right? Right? We were talking about opportunity costs. We need to start looking at how we can actually be more efficacious with our time. Be more effective, be more effectual, be more productive. How can we improve, especially in this effort? We really need to, you know, we need to get to an optimal operational point. My father, when he, in the 60s, actually it was in the 70s, he worked for an organization called Success Motivation Institute. And one of the things that they went around and helped people learn and understand is that you're typically, most people are not operating at their maximum efficiency or their maximum potential. And what he did was he used, they used these little metaphors or these little, you know, adages, you know, of operating, you know. So one of the things he had was a this little sign that said, today I will operate at 212 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, what does that mean? What is 212 degrees Fahrenheit and why that? 212 degrees Fahrenheit, when you look at the optimum capacity of water in its optimum function, you know, its maximum capability, 212 degrees is it. It can't get beyond 212 degrees, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can water get below 32 degrees? The temperature can be lower than 32 degrees, but one of the reasons why they actually use a misting process on citrus fruits when the temperature starts getting below 32 degrees is, and they, so they turn these little water spigots on with these anti-frost things, and they do this to put a glaze of frost on the fruit so that there's like this little, you know, shell of ice surrounding the citrus fruit. Did you know they do that?
I did not.
They do that because ice will not drop below 32 degrees. It's incapable of doing that. It is its lowest temperature. Therefore, because the fruit can actually go below that, and the fruit can sustain itself at 32 degrees, but once it gets below a certain degree, it gets damaged. And they realize that by creating an ice protection on the fruit, they were capable of saving their crops. It's a pretty expensive process, which is why they try to really avoid, you know, that type of condition, because there's also these other circumstances, wind and those types of things, where certain fruit may just have too much wind on it, where the water doesn't build up enough of a shell to, you know, freeze the fruit. So there's these risks you're still going to lose, but you don't lose all your crop. But the point is that, are we operating at our maximum capacity? And so my father, because the human body is primarily what? Water, right? We're maybe carbon-based, but we're primarily water. And so, you know, they basically helped everybody understand that we should be as water-based beings and carbon-based, but primarily water. Our optimum capacity would be about 212 degrees for water, scientifically. So that is, you know, saying today I will operate at 212 degrees Fahrenheit means I'm going to do everything I can to make the most, to be the most, you know, to use the day to its optimum in my productivity and everything I do. Does that make sense now? So that one little blurb, today I will operate, it kind of reminds him that he, you know, we need to be focused on operating in our optimum potential. The reason why we meander, this is why I do, at the end of every year, I try to help people by setting goals and how to effectively obtain those goals. And every year I tell you that if you don't have little reminders that you see on a regular basis to remind you, my father wanted, at one point in time, he, you know, when he was very materialistic, he wanted an XKE, a Jaguar XKE. And so he had that, a picture, different pictures of a Jaguar, you know, everywhere. It was on his rear view mirror in his car. He had it on the bathroom window or mirror in their bathroom. He placed these little reminders, and then finally, you know, he got to a point where he realized, well, as, you know, as trying to be a man of God, he felt that maybe I was being too materialistic, and he kind of abandoned that. But still, if you don't have these reminders, these little visual reminders to help you focus, that's how you change your daily routine. You've got to have these little reminders. Today, I'm going to do this. Today, I'm going to do this. Today, I'm going to do this. And by seeing those things, it actually helps you change behavior so that you do what you're supposed to do instead of doing the things that you gravitate to. That makes sense, right? Yeah?
Yes, it does.
Okay. All right. So you're off doing something. You're not even paying attention. Well, I hope...
No, I am paying attention.
Okay.
I'm agreeing with you. Yeah, it makes sense whether we do it or not. That's another story.
Well, there you go. But see, you have to actually take the time, the little time, the opportunity cost. You want to be successful? You actually have to spend a little opportunity cost. Instead of turning TV on tonight, go make a bunch of little signs. And then go put those signs up, one on the refrigerator. Go put those signs up everywhere that you occasionally, not even occasionally, regularly go look, touch, and be in front of. In front of the bathroom mirror. In front of the kitchen refrigerator. You know, the front door. You know, when you're walking out the house. Place these reminders throughout your life, and it will help you be more focused. If you do
just
that,
just like little pop-ups on your phone all the time.
That too, but I mean, just having.
That's what I do.
But having physical is another. The better and the more effectively you're reminding yourself, right? I mean, people have temptations, right? I mean, what is it? Every 10 seconds, a guy thinks sex, right? Something like that. That's this scientific.
You tell me.
I don't even know if it's scientific or not, but that's what I've heard people assert, that, you know, men, you know, just think sex so often, it's like every 10 seconds, and it is a burden for any good man to basically discipline himself so that he doesn't. The point is this, that for us to, you know, try to not be gravitated towards, you know, eating, smoking, whatever the addiction is, gambling or what have you, you have to remind yourself to be in the game, the winning game, to not do those things you don't want to do, or to do the things you need to do, or do the things that will improve your life. It's all about programming, and you have the ability to program yourself. So the whole point of me spending the amount of time that I have already into this, 10 minutes. The whole point of this is that I think we in the Patriot Movement need to, you know, be more, you know, regular in re-examining what are we doing, is what we're doing, you know, in holding a meeting, in, you know, having these sessions or what have you, is this really helping? If you're receiving content and you're learning, learning is good. That's why I truly believe that what we do on this show, bar none, is above any and all shows out there, because we're providing you content that you need to understand. As a patriot and somebody that is looking to restore our republic, to reclaim our republic, we have to understand the Constitution. There's no better documentation, there's no better source than the ratification debates. And I've proven this. So bottom line, what you are doing, what we're doing, and I'm just inviting everybody because, you know, who isn't frustrated? Who isn't feeling like we're not getting anywhere? You know, every time we look at what's going on in the White House, things aren't going to change until we start demanding the changes we want. I keep on telling, you know, people like Michelle. You know, Michelle, but you talk about working with explosives. She is explosive. She wants to just go and actually start, you know, utilizing and demanding the and expecting the full force of the law. And I, you know, like using Section 3 to get rid of people. And I have to remind her that the only way we're going to get people, the ability for us people to get rid of our public servants, is we have to put public servants in office that will actually actualize that. In other words, they'll make the laws and they will make sure that they are enforced. We have to make sure that they do that. Right? We get people to run campaigns. How many times have we had somebody, oh, I'm going to go do this, and they don't. They say whatever they need to, and they get your vote, and then they go off and do what they want to do. That's a typical politician. We actually have to make sure, we have to follow up, and we have to be demanding. And we have to be the squeaky wheel so that we get the oil we need, we so badly need. So anyway, forgive me for doing this little, because I went straight down this path. But I believe that when I do, because every year, like I said, I do these things talking about goals and how to be more efficacious. Well, if I'm not reminding ourselves that we need to do this, then maybe I'm failing you. So I figured, well, because we, Tammy and I were just talking about opportunity costs and understanding what that term means. So if we're not evaluating our opportunity costs with everything that we're doing, then we're wasting time. And I don't think anybody has, you know, that kind of time to waste. I don't think we have that kind of time to waste. Now, that all makes sense, right? Am I leaving anything undone? GR, maybe you need to do this, say this, or, you know, I need to hear that, or what? Anything?
To me, I just feel like, I don't know.
I'm just trying to say, all I'm doing is I'm trying to say what I think people need to hear more on a regular basis. And I know it's, again, 14 minutes into this. I'm, you know, I don't want to spend a lot of time, but now I have to explain myself why I'm doing this. And so I think I thoroughly explained we need on a regular basis to remind ourselves that we need to be doing these things. I can't just take for granted that everybody has created these reminders. And until we do have reminders, I am equally guilty because I don't create enough reminders, because there's plenty of things I need to be doing. I actually have a schedule. I've religiously worked on that schedule. I could do better. We can all do better. And that is the whole point, and I'm concluding with 14 and a half minutes. So there we go. Now we're covering the ratification debates. Oh, let me go through the obligatories. One of the things is, as you know, the debt is fraud. In our appeals to heaven, we need to learn, pray, act. And it is always, always focusing on the entire, full compliance to the entire Constitution. No cherry-picking. Cherry pickers get us to obviate the rest of the Constitution. Whenever you focus on one thing, you turn your back on everything else. And when it comes to the magnitude of the problem, we cannot afford to turn our back on all of those things we're turning our backs on. Period. I don't care how important what you think your thing is. There's that many more evil things behind us that will, you know, will easily overcome us. So, with all that being said, one other thing, I talk about tech, and I need to remind everybody because it's actually I got reminded yesterday. Microsoft Windows 10 is no longer going to be supported. I believe it is mid-October, 14th, 15th, something like that. So if you don't have Windows 11, don't let them scare you. You can still function on Windows 10 in your own little world and what have you, and having your own documentation and having, you know, if you have to go down the path because you've got to interoperate with other people, because eventually what they're going to do with this new platform security is they're going to basically try to make the network, the internet, hostile towards non-compliant systems. Does that make sense? Mm. Because it's not going to happen overnight, but they want to get to a point where they can literally get away with being hostile and saying your browser won't work anymore on your computer. So utilizing the internet will be very hard for you to even function. And I'm looking at a point where I may not be able to update my website anymore due to some of these types of things. And my website may become obsolete. There, you know, even though I have a really old school website, why do we need to change it? Everything should be backwards compatible. Those who are the advocates for the New World Order cannot allow us to maintain any type of autonomy or any type of those things that give us the freedom. They need to control everything. And it's imperative that they do that. And they want to convince everybody that the world would be better when we're all under full control. And your kids are believing this too. Your kids are being taught this, and they're literally accepting this concept of full control. Now, I don't know about Wyoming, but
100%.
What's that?
100%, because you think about kids, and it's like they don't even mind being tracked wherever they go. That's just normal to them.
Right. Right. And all they have to do is realize that now they've allowed themselves to live in a world where they have no liberties. They can't think otherwise. Anyway, okay, so we're in the ratification debates, the North Carolina debates, and we were just diving into this comment by Mr. Spencer. Now, he's an anti-federalist. So what he's saying has no legal binding. What he's saying is really more of a hyperbole and or derogatory things that, you know, are not in favor of the Constitution. And they're, 9 times out of 10, folks, they're colored with lies and deceit. So I wanted to kind of throw this in because I want people to actually see this. And towards the end of the anti-federal or towards the end of the ratification debates, you can see how anybody that's listening and you're listening to the conflict, there was a reason why, you know, these men were very open and objective people. And there was a reason why they had these different debates, because those who did not want the Constitution to be ratified were willing to say and do anything to keep that from happening, because there was a lot of money and control at the state level on the line. And people didn't care about what was better. They cared about maintaining what they had. Nobody wants to lose land. Nobody wants to lose property. And when people have control over you, you become their property. And this is just a new, every generation and every culture, it's an evolving thing. So go ahead, let's dive into Mr. Spencer's jurisdiction comments.
All right, Mr. Chairman, I have objections to this article. I object to the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal court in all cases of law and equity arising under the Constitution and the laws of the United States, and to the appellate jurisdiction of controversies between the citizens of different states, and a few other instances. To these I object because I believe they will be oppressive in their operation. I would wish that the federal court should not interfere or have anything to do with controversies to the decision of which the state judiciaries might be fully competent, nor with such controversies as must carry the people a great way from home.
Okay, so one of the okay, so let me, because that was red on my end. I've kind of highlighted that. So and you, and that's fine. So when the people see this, when I post all of these, they'll be all updated. So when you look at the very beginning, he has an objection to this article. I object to the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal court in all cases of law and equity arising under this Constitution and the laws of the United States. Now, technically, that's a semicolon. And it should include, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority. Another semicolon. And so that's where the federal government should have, because we've delegated the responsibility for them to do these things, not giving them exclusive jurisdiction over those things that we've granted them with, then, unless it's a restriction. If it's a restriction, then they shouldn't have jurisdiction on it. So, when it comes to those things that have been delegated, him objecting to this is almost like saying, what? Hold on here. We want to empower somebody to do something, but we want to object their jurisdiction over that. That's an oxymoron. Does that make sense? What he's saying at the very beginning is he leads off with an oxymoron, and then he dives into the part that all the other state anti-federalists pointed out, that it could be opening a Pandora's box by allowing them to have jurisdiction over between citizens of another state and your state, or foreigners in your state, and so forth, to giving them that kind of jurisdiction. So what he's saying here is a repeat, or he's basically regurgitating what we've heard in several other debates, Virginia, Massachusetts, so forth. So the reality is this. Ultimately, as they went forward on the Constitution, it only took 5 years. 1794 is when the states demanded the 11th Amendment. The 11th Amendment was ratified in 1798. It took another 4 years to ratify. But the states did it. They got it through. They got it across the finish line. The federal courts have no jurisdiction between the states and a citizen of another state. So when you look at the 11th Amendment today, it is not being followed because the entire court system, based on the bar and its wide-sweeping, broad grasp of all things legal, they have assumed jurisdiction over everything. And they only use jurisdiction and standing literally today for political purposes, so that they, you know, don't have this perception out there that they're getting involved in a political matter like elections that they don't want to be involved in. In other words, when they use those arguments of, well, we don't have jurisdiction, or this, you don't have standing, they use those types of arguments to basically accept this idea that we are okay with the problem, because their modus operandi is that everything under the sun is for us to hear. And now they want to apply this, oh, well, we shouldn't be hearing this because of standing or jurisdiction. What? You know, what the heck happened? You know, you guys have you take jurisdiction over life. You take jurisdiction over labor and housing and environment. Things you have no jurisdiction arising under the Constitution, and you assume jurisdiction over it. I mean, they bend over backwards assuming jurisdiction. This is an indictment of how far the court is out of control. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let's get back to what he was basically saying. But for the most part, folks, I find it interesting how the anti-federalists were really saying, well, we just have a real problem with this whole federal judiciary. Now, when you look at the Articles of Confederation, you can actually see how there was no jurisdiction. Actually, there was no federal court. There was no Continental Congress court. The Continental Congress was the court, and then they would establish what the court would be. In other words, that's why I say when you really look at Continental Congress, they were more of a magistrate form of government, because here they were, you know, basically this... the purveyors of all under this auspices of this, you know, Articles of Confederation. However, they had no authority, which is one of the reasons why they needed to create the coercive powers of taxation and so forth. So anyway, I digress. Let's go ahead and get back into these anti-federalist comments. Go ahead.
With respect to the jurisdiction... Hold on, I gotta shift something around. With respect to the jurisdiction of eases arising
under the
Constitution,
that should be cases. That's a misprint.
When we reflect on the very.
So you didn't hear what I said. Those are cases, not eases. So it's with respect to the jurisdiction of cases arising under the jurisdiction, under the Constitution, or I should say under the Constitution. That should be cases. That was a typo from I don't know when. Way back in the beginning, whatever. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. With respect to the jurisdiction of cases arising under the Constitution, when we reflect on the very extensive objects of the plan of government, the manner in which they may arise, and the multiplicity of laws that may be made with respect to them, the objection against it will appear to be well-founded. If we consider nothing but the articles of taxation, duties, and excises, and the laws that might be made with respect to these, the cases will be almost infinite. If we consider that it is in contemplation that a stamp duty shall take place throughout the continent, that all contracts shall be on stamp paper, that no contract shall be of validity but what would be thus stamped, these cases will be so many that the consequences would be dreadful. It would be necessary to appoint judges to the Federal Supreme Court and other inferior departments, as such a number of inferior courts in every district and county, with a correspondent number of officers, that it would cost an immense expense without any apparent necessity, which must operate to the distress of the inhabitants. There will be, without any manner of doubt, clashing and animosities between the jurisdiction of the federal courts and of the state courts, so that they will keep the country in hot water. It has been said that the impropriety of this was mentioned by some in the convention. I cannot see the reasons of giving the federal courts jurisdiction in these cases. But I am sure it will occasion great expense unnecessarily. The state judiciaries will have very little to do. It will be almost useless to keep them up. All officers are to take an oath to support the general government, it will carry everything before it. This will produce the consolidation through the United States, which is apprehended. I am sure that I do not see that it is possible to avoid it. I can see no power that can keep up the little remains of the power of the states. Our rights are not guarded. There is no declaration of rights to secure to every member of the society those unalienable rights which ought not to be given up to any government. Such a Bill of Rights would be a check upon men in power. Instead of such a Bill of Rights, this Constitution has a clause which may warrant encroachments on the power of the respective state legislatures. I know it is said that what is not given up to the United States will be retained by the individual states. I know it ought to be so and should be so understood, but, sir, it is not declared to be so. In the Confederation, it is expressly declared that all rights and powers of any kind whatever of the several states which are not given up to the United States are expressly and absolutely retained to be enjoyed by the states. There ought to be a Bill of Rights in order that those in power may not step over the boundary between the powers of government and the rights of the people, which they may do when there is nothing to prevent them. They may do so without a Bill of Rights. Notice will not be readily taken of the encroachments of rulers, and they may go to a great length before the people are alarmed. Oppression may therefore take place by degrees, but if there were express terms and bounds laid down when these were passed by the people, would take notice of them, and oppressions would not be carried to such a length. I look upon it, therefore, that there ought to be something to confine the power of this government within its proper boundaries. I know that several writers have said that a Bill of Rights is not necessary in this country, that some states had them not, and that others had. To these I answer that those states that have them not as Bills of Rights, strictly so called, have them in the frame of their constitution, which is nearly the same.
Okay, so, I'm sorry about the delay. So, in what he was saying, he stated up at the very top, when we reflect on the extensive objects of the plan of government, the manner in which they may arise, and the multiplicity of laws that may be made with respect to them, the objection against it will appear to be well-founded. Now, he's talking about in cases under the Constitution. It is clear, and as a matter of fact, one of the things that actually created precedence was the term of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, because there were many times when Congress tried to create such as the Department of Transportation under Madison, where Madison vetoed that. He said, those powers don't exist in this Constitution. In other words, we were blessed at the very beginning of somebody that was the exemplar in acting the way the Constitution had been defined and the language of the Constitution, that laws in pursuance to the Constitution. And so the whole point is that as what he's talking about, as far as wandering outside and creating laws that are not in pursuance to the Constitution, that only can occur if we allow the federal government in any capacity to redefine the Constitution. Ergo, when Congress goes and they, well, we're going to redefine this, you know, this establishing post roads as being able to build post roads. Hold on here. That's not what that power states. You establish, you basically say, these are what the post roads would be, and then the states would have to then build them. Well, now they want to basically, because they can tax and you start using this tax machine. No, the tax machine does not offer or create and expand powers just because they can tax and get money to do it. They actually have to have the power to do that before they tax. You don't use the tax process to basically say, now we can spend recklessly. No, you can only spend on those things enumerated. So the whole point, as he's talking, because he even goes further into the last part to talk about the Bill of Rights and all those types of things. But the reality is this, because he even uses this other example, this right below this. He says, if we consider that it is contemplated that a stamp duty shall take place throughout the continent. Hold on here. There's no stamp duty within the Constitution. For them to actually go down the path of creating that type of tax, they would have to change the Constitution, because the Constitution has direct taxes, or a duty, which is the apportionment tax. That's what's identified. The duty is the apportionment tax. The 16th Amendment took away the apportionment tax, which was an allocation based on citizens, how many citizens per state. So basically it's this much per citizen, and we levy it out to all of the states evenly based on how many citizens they have. That's what they pay. So in looking at the apportionment tax and that duty, this idea that he's throwing this out there, that they could create a stamp duty, why is that important? Why was he doing that? Because the stamp tax was the, you know, was one of those taxes that's really got people to go over the deep end and scream revolt against Britain. Because it was a very onerous type of tax, where they literally got expanded through, as they proved right here. They contained the way the taxes could be done. Excise taxes, right? Imposts and duties, and the duties were apportionment based. It was all a simple apportionment tax. So my point is how slick the soothsayers were in trying to cast these types of paradigms. The novice reader, when they read these things, they take this as gospel doctrine, you know, truth, it's a gold standard, and this is what's going to happen. That's why when we really see the names of the people, and we think, wow, this is Patrick Henry. Wow, this is Samuel Adams. And actually, I'm really impressed with Samuel Adams and even John Hancock, because they kind of reserved themselves. They didn't want to speak out because they really weren't sure. They were understanding how things were, but when John Hancock brought up the option of basically recommending certain amendments, it gave Samuel Adams the ease of saying, you know what, I can ratify this because I believe that is the best way to go forward. He knew, Samuel Adams knew, and there's a lot of people out there that point to Samuel Adams. Oh, he didn't go to the convention because he didn't think we needed a new constitution. No, he knew that the Articles of Confederation were defunct. He knew that, but he was, you know, how old was this guy? He, you know, a lot of these guys didn't live much longer. You know, George Washington died within the next decade. A lot of these guys were in, you know, because they were the beginners and the, I'll just say, they were the established influencers in the 60s, the 1760s, of, you know, helping get organized against Britain. That was Samuel Adams. Their life expectancy wasn't like we see today. And if you look at, you know, how long Thomas Jefferson and John Adams lived, I mean, that those are outliers right there. But anyway, long story short, as we kind of look at what he's really trying to say here, this is how the Anti-Federalists think and how they operate. The other thing he points out is he says, as all officers, because I want to highlight this, as all officers are to take an oath to support the general government. Is that what they do? What do they do? They take an oath to support what?
Defend the Constitution.
The Constitution. Not a party, not a person, not a place, not a thing. An office? None of that. They were to support the Constitution. In other words, its original definitions, and that's it. If you want to change that definition, then we need to amend the Constitution to allocate that type of change. Clearly, that's all. And so I just wanted to point these types of things out, because it's not often that we have anti-federalists, and so when we do, I really want to make sure that everybody kind of goes, oh, okay, now Mr. Spate talks about jurisdiction of the judiciary. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the gentleman insinuates that differences existed in the Federal Convention respecting the clauses which he objects to. Whoever told him so was wrong, for I declare that in the Convention, the unanimous desire of all was to keep separate and distinct the objects of the jurisdiction of the federal from that of the state judiciary. They wished to separate them as judiciously as possible and to consult the case and convenience of the people. The gentleman objects to the cognizance of all cases in law and equity arising under the Constitution and the laws of the United States. This objection is very astonishing. When any government is established, it ought to have power to enforce its laws, or else it might as well have no power. What but that is the use of a judiciary? The gentleman from this his profession must know that no government can exist without a judiciary to enforce its laws by distinguishing the disobedient from the rest of the people and imposing sanctions for securing the execution of the laws. As to the inconvenience of distant attendance, Congress has power of establishing inferior tribunals in each state so as to accommodate every citizen. As Congress have it in their power, will they not do it? Are we to elect men who will wantonly and unnecessarily betray us?
I'm sorry, go ahead. I'm sorry, absolutely. So he's laid that out, and Mr. McLean kind of jumps on top of this. I apologize. I thought maybe you'd just keep going to the next one, because there's really nothing, There's really nothing to, you know, these aren't anti-federalists. I don't think these guys are, you know, I think what they're saying is very, very clear. And then, so Mr. McLean, just so for the benefit of everybody else, Mr. McLean then goes into this little assertion. And then he talks about the Bill of Rights and enumerating powers, right? So we'll then be going into that. And then he talks about this, you know, in the Bill of Rights, there's some red text where we're going to want to dive into a little bit, because this is where they're really, you know, dissecting this concept of why do you need a Bill of Rights in this type of compact, in this type of power of attorney. And actually, when it comes down to the Bill of Rights, this is really, this right here, to me, is probably the all-star band, you know, for at least North Carolina, if not in the state debates, because I think Madison, Nicholas, they did a good job. But I think my favorite, you know, and how they really they dissect this is in these few assertions by these few men, because Mr. Bloodworth then speaks up, and then Mr. McDowell by trial by jury, Mr. Spate, and then Mr. Iredell. And out of all of these comments, Mr. Iredell and what he says, and we won't get to this today because this is a lot of reading we're going to be doing, but we'll get to this tomorrow. And this is where he actually mentions a power of attorney when he starts talking about a Bill of Rights and so forth. So anyway, let's go ahead and just keep going. And if you would, when you get to the new, you know, topic changes like jurisdiction, Bill of Rights, you could just go ahead. Okay, now the topic changes to this. So go ahead.
Okay.
All right, great. Thanks.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I hoped that some gentleman more capable than myself would have obviated the objections to this part. The objections offered by the gentleman appear to me totally without foundation. He told us that these clauses tended to a consolidation of the states. I cannot see how states are to be consolidated by establishing these two clauses. He enumerated a number of cases which would be involved with the cognizance of the federal courts, customs, excises, duties, stamp duties, a stamp on every article, on every contract, in order to bring all persons into the federal court. And I said that there would be necessarily courts in every district and county, which would be attended with enormous and needless expense, for that the state courts could do everything. He went on further and said that there would be a necessity of having sheriffs and other officers in these inferior departments. A wonderful picture indeed, drawn up in the wonderful manner. I will venture to say that The gentleman's suggestions are not warranted by any reasonable construction of the Constitution. The laws can, in general, be executed by officers of the states. State courts and state officers will, for the most part, probably answer the purpose of Congress as well as any other. But the gentleman says that the state's courts will be swallowed up by the federal courts. This is only a general assertion, unsupported by any probable reasons or arguments. The objects of each are separate and distinct. I suppose that whatever courts there may be, they will be established according to the convenience of the people. This we must suppose from the mode of electing and appointing the members of the government. State officers will as much as possible be employed for one very considerable reason. I mean to lessen the expense. But he imagines that the oath to be taken by officers will tend to the subversion of our state governments and of our liberty. Can any government exist without fidelity in its officers? Ought not the officers of every government to give some security for the faithful discharge of their trust? The officers are only to be sworn to support the Constitution, and therefore will only be bound by their oath so far as it shall be strictly pursued. No officer will be bound by his oath to support any act that would violate the principles of the Constitution.
Right, so there you go in when they kind of talk about the Constitution right there. So he kind of followed up from the general government to say the principles of the Constitution. The interesting thing is, because this is the battle I fight today when trying to teach people, when we look at the Constitution, we're not looking at the hard fixed Constitution and its definitions that have never legitimately been changed. Now, there have been points out the gate when the federal government did those few things very specifically to make sure that they did. So the initial oath of office, the initial concept, and the act of administering the oath, which was the very first act of Congress, they made sure that everybody, if you were employed, if you received a pay, any type of compensation as an employee, like in the General Accounting Office, they created the General Accounting Office because somebody needed to go out and procure the pencils and paper and the chairs and the things necessary for the legislators to be able to use in Congress and for the president to have in his, you know, administration, as well as the courts to be able to use in their buildings. So they had to have, you know, this basic administrative function, right? So every employee that worked for the General Accounting Office had to take an oath. That's why the oath was required of everybody. Even though the Constitution said that they demanded upon all states that all let me go to the Constitution, because the Constitution itself actually declares very specifically who are to take the oath at a minimum. And it says, the senators and representatives before mentioned and the members of the several state legislatures and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound. So at a minimum, those people who are in the primary branches of government, they needed to be under oath and bound to support this Constitution. It went beyond that in the very first session of Congress that they said, we want everybody in the federal government to do this. They couldn't create, and they didn't go about to create an amendment to the Constitution. They set a standard. And so all of the states started following that. And Wyoming did when they became a state. And Wyoming's oath of office is not only to support, but is to defend and obey the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of Wyoming. And they apply it to almost everybody under the sun in Wyoming, because everybody started understanding this importance of having a legally bound person in public office or in public service. Why is it that we stopped with educators? Why is it that anybody that is receiving income from the taxpayer, for them to be in their job, Why is it that they're not required to support the Constitution? Because I'll tell you what, if you had every educator in the entire education system in the United States under oath to support the Constitution, we would have a much better education system. Especially if we were holding
the school board members.
But pardon me, what? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
At least the school board members, at the very least.
At the very, but the teachers, if you're receiving, even the janitor, if you are making money off of tax dollars, it just boggles my mind that you could become an insurgent against the Constitution. Especially the way ideologies have festered to a point, and these people have direct access to your kids.
Yeah. What?
This is why the entire education system really must be dismantled. This is why, and I'll say this because we've talked about yaymath.org and how you could take that guy and use his content, in teaching all kids math. There's no politics involved, and the whole point is that we need to go to an education system where the teachers actually record their content so that everybody can watch every minute of what they say and what they do. That way we can make sure that if they utter anything that is ideological to basically, because I'm okay with kids coming up with their own doctrines of what they want to be exposed to. But when it comes from 0 to 18, those who should be influencing their ideology must be their parents. That is an inalienable right. They're the creators of that child, them and God. And if they make a compact with God to bring that child up in the ways of the Lord, then that's on them. And that should be respected absolutely to the nth degree. We as a society, states don't create children. States should not be involved in the rearing of children. This concept, because we've talked about this before as well, it just bothers me that we have to create a standard that you can't have kids if you don't have a home that's adequate. You know, it's got to have electricity. You've got to have a separate room for every child, you know, and they got to have a certain type of bed. I mean, if everybody had if we went to the nth degree in making sure that the best environment was provided, nobody could have kids, or at least the majority of the people in America couldn't have kids. And how did America, then we have to scratch our heads, how did America get to this point? I mean, how do we become so great with such austere conditions, right? When we look at, you know, Lincoln in those days, everybody lived in one big room. They didn't have multi-room cabins. Shoot, they were just, you know.
Yeah, and many people all over the world still live in one room.
There you go. There you go. So we ran out of time. But, I mean, this is a perfect point. You know, what are we doing? Are we actually, you know, overreaching? And we are. We're definitely way overreaching. It's kind of like, you know, creating building standards. I'm okay if you build a shack on a beach and a hurricane knocks you down. You just got to replace it, and it's just a shack. Anyway, as what we're doing here, folks. Hopefully, this is all making sense. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.